Welcome to The Green Urbanist, the podcast for urbanists fighting climate change. I'm Ross. Today's episode is a conversation with Glenn Howells Architects. I speak to Will Poole, who's a partner, Jack Pritchard, associate urban designer, and Sophia Seneda, architect and sustainability lead at Glenn Howells Architects. They are based in London and Birmingham, and they've designed award-winning housing, tall buildings, and master plans across the UK. Our conversation focuses on how, over the last few years, they've shifted their approach towards sustainable design and developed their own studio culture and internal processes for delivering sustainable projects. If you're interested in how to embed sustainability within a design practice, you'll definitely get a lot of insights from this conversation. We also talk about the challenges of designing sustainable tall buildings and some of their thoughts on designing for climate adaptation. Really hope you enjoyed this conversation as much as I did. Do you want to just introduce yourselves for the listeners? I'll start with you, Will.
Yeah, hi Ross. Thank you for visiting us as well. I'm William Poole. I'm partner in the London office of Glenn Howells Architects. I've been with the practice for 15 years and primarily overseeing residential-led development, and in particular quite a lot of master plans that are sort of multi-plot and several years in the delivery.
Thanks. Yes, Jack Pritchard, associate urban designer at Glenn Howells Architects, trained as a urban design and with a planning background as well.
Yeah, I'm Sophia. I've been at Glenn Howells for 8 years now, and I'm an architect trained with actually environment studies as part of my part two. So I have, you know, a passionate approach to design sustainable buildings. I'm sustainability lead for Glenn Howells Architects, and I'm based in the London office.
Fantastic. Do you want to get started talking a little bit about your internal approach to sustainability? How are you sort of trying to integrate that into all your projects now?
Yeah, I guess in some ways we would always have regarded ourselves as a practice who thinks about this at first principles in our design process anyway. But I think in the last certainly 2 or 3 years that has very much hardened in the industry as something that needs to be demonstrated to ourselves as something that's tangible and we, you know, can stand up to the scrutiny of our own internal design process and all of the targets that we're now subscribed to. We've got two, I guess, ways of controlling and measuring how we design and how we design sustainably. One of them is a design, kind of a design philosophy. It's an acronym called CLEAN, which Glenn devised a few years ago, really with the intent of making all of our staff aware of the guiding principles of design. And obviously, like probably many other practices would say, we don't have a house style, it's an approach and it's a philosophy. So that acronym stands for crafted, lean, elegant, appropriate, and narrative. And those are the five things that we generally judge our design progress by. We often say that narrative is the most important, but obviously the L for lean is the sustainable part, where we do the most with the least material and resources.
Mm. Okay, that's interesting. So it's sort of it's almost like a minimalism approach rather than adding on lots of tech to make it sustainable. It's sort of saying, what can we take out to keep it lean? I like that.
Yeah. That's right. So ideally, everything has at least one purpose, and ideally more than one in a building. And I guess a lot of that comes from the structural rigor of the buildings. Generally, quite rational buildings that obviously the structure is a guiding principle for how the building ultimately performs and is programmed and how it looks. We do spend a lot of time focusing on that to make sure that the buildings are a sort of lean product of that process.
Maybe if I go over to you, Sophia, can you tell us a little bit about what your role is and how you're trying to embed sustainability in the process?
Yeah, so we started about 4 years ago, in fact, looking at, obviously net zero carbon was starting to almost be in, you know, part of the UK obligations. And we started to think about a roadmap, what we needed to do and how we could embed sustainable design more consistently, more coherently, measure it, you know, look at benchmark. And share knowledge also within the practice, the two practices, the two offices. You know, there's a lot of knowledge and good knowledge, but not necessarily, you know, we didn't necessarily have that shared knowledge across both practices. So looking at all this element, we started in 2018, 2019, starting to be more specific about principles and targets. And I happened to join ACAN, the Architects Climate Action Network, very early on in October in 2019, and also discovered the work of LETI, the London Energy Transformation Initiative. So I started to put together what I call this sustainable design checklist, which look at, you know, starting by, which in effect embrace very much the principle that LETI has, you know, published in their works. Amazing work, by the way. But it's very much that. Part of it is obviously historical from the GHG perspective in terms of using less material, try to reuse existing, using with passive principle in mind for services and for in terms of form orientation, you also with efficient services in mind, working closely with, you know, the MEP for having the best solutions at the, and produce the most efficient buildings. So yeah, we've been on a journey, gradually we started to look at our project. So these sustainable design checklists allow us to look at, you know, in general, how well do you apply these principles, and allows us to kind of benchmark our own project, you know. So we did a few like this, and then some open source tools have emerged, like the Mesh Energy tool for carbon calculation, the Fiedland, Clare and Bradley Studio tool for carbon calculation, and we look at all these tools and, you know, checked what was best for us to use within the culture of the organization, because I think that's quite important as well. Obviously, measuring carbon emission 10 years ago was hardly spoken about, all of a sudden it emerged, but not everybody is that way minded in terms of when you work in a design practice. So we wanted to find the best way to make sure that the studio would work towards this assessment. And we nominated some studio champions, and you know, sometimes they were great at it, and we got some results. And all of this allowed us really to look at project and to just decide and to see, decide about or design options and decision, and see, you know, what was not so low carbon about it and what was low carbon. And I kind of always thought about it as low carbon design, not really net zero carbon, because I think we can help deliver low carbon design building in terms of a net zero carbon process is an add-on which is not necessarily within our remit. So, you know, that's so, yeah, and we're still on a journey, to be honest with you, and obviously knowledge sharing. And now I think the one of the main things is circular economy obviously is the way forward. There's no other way. Reducing demand for resources, so it's about having making the demand for it, but also, you know, we're relying on other processes to happen within the cities, for instance, for, you know, database of material available, et cetera, et cetera. So we are, you know, keeping abreast of all these developments to make sure that we can tap on the best resources to move our design forward.
So it's an enormously complicated subject that Sophia has helped us to grapple with as an organisation. I guess what the brief we set to her, which is what we have now up and running across the practice, is that we're able fairly simply, and for all of the staff to engage with this checklist and toolkit, we're able to test all of our early stage projects and generate a kind of score, which is based not just around carbon, that's part of it, but also about transport, well-being, community, and the wider environment, as well as the building fabric. So by having that score, we're able to tweak and adjust things through dialogue with client brief about their brief and with engineers, and show tangible improvements through that before lots of these principles get locked into a planning design.
Yeah, I think this is something that also very early on we tried to make everybody aware of, is that it was very important and very critical to engage with a client from the onset, from stage zero, make sure there was a client brief that, you know, looked at principle and targets, and also the key actors in the project, the key consultants. So making sure, yeah, that everybody, because obviously the, you know, the opportunities to, you know, for reducing carbon emission in particular, you know, drop dramatically as you go forward in the project. So if you start to look at it at stage three, you already lost quite a great amount of possibilities. So our best project was when the client was very forward about it, and we do have some good clients in that respect. And when we had also the construction team, you know, as part of these early stages, that was quite important in terms of looking at a sustainable procurement plan. And, you know, what can be done with existing assets, for instance. So we had one project where we had, you know, historical steel on site, you know, and at least it was considered, you know, at the time, you know, whether or not the steel could be reused. Obviously, we need to be retested, certified, and, you know, make good, etc. But, you know, all this discussion is really important. So it was important also that everybody was aware of that, that this is not something you know, you leave for the later stage in design. Sorry.
Yeah, not something you leave just for one person to do.
Yeah, well, absolutely not. Yeah.
That's what we've seen change dramatically in the last 3 years, really, is that it's not just us or the design team pushing, but we're being held to account. The whole industry is holding each other to account for doing better. And that's it's obviously the local authorities, and it's policy changing as well, but it's most definitely our clients and their funders as well behind them. Yeah. So it's really changed things around, and it's great that everybody's sort of finally pulling in the same direction.
Did 2019 seem like a turning point for accelerating this stuff?
Probably 2020, I would say, is the year where things started to accelerate. But there are larger clients I know have developed, you know, their client brief, and in terms of sustainability, in terms of the way we look at sustainability today, already a few years before. So, yeah, probably, I don't know why you suggest 2019 in particular, but 2020 seems to be the year where there were loads of work publication and also consultation with the government, you know, the consultation going on about the Future Home Standard and the PAL, you know, all happened in that period. So I think, yeah, there was a momentum there, certainly also with Leti's work, where they published their climate emergency primer and the other guidance all around, you know, how to reduce embodied carbon. So, yeah.
I wonder, to sort of bring this to life, I suppose, for people listening, can you tell us a little bit about some of your projects and how you've applied this, and a little bit about that, and buildings as well as sort of larger urban scale stuff?
So part of the work that Sophia is doing with the project testing has obviously included some of our legacy projects, if you like, designs that were committed several years before 2019-2020, which can show us where we're starting from in order that we can demonstrate an improvement on that. Those have included one that's very recently completed in Canary Wharf called Wardian, which is a very high density pair of towers of 50 and 55 stories of apartments. Now, that design was conceived in around 2012, so it's been a 10-year process to have that built. And it's been interesting for us to see, both in terms of the structure, fabric, embodied carbon content, but also the wider implications of that kind of development on sustainable living. And that's a good example where you're within 2 or 3 minutes walk of Jubilee Line and other transport networks. And it's somewhere that's increasingly regarded as a mixed-use neighbourhood. It's no longer the financial district that it was originally. And so there's great many benefits that go with building high and building very dense there, which include, you know, virtually no reliance on car ownership, less burden on the transport network, benefits to the local economy, and all of those things.
Yeah, I mean, you're seeing that increasingly become part of the narrative, isn't it? And that's probably one of the harder things to start to benchmark, is that, you know, there are some real positives of tall buildings and high density and that energy dimension of cities. And you can compare the sprawl of America and the amount of gasoline that cities like Atlanta use versus, you know, New York, and this maybe slightly jarring narrative or vision that the idea of New York being, you know, or any high density city or tall city being the model of a green city, you know, it's got that face of, you know, steel, glass, concrete, but as a efficient use of resources obviously does particularly well. And I think that's part of the challenge is obviously how people go about living their day-to-day lives, maybe very sustainable for the world reasons that we'll referred to, but it's also then sort of reconciling that with the construction of tall buildings as well and the built fabric that goes with it. So I think we are seeing certainly a shift and more is continuing to happen, isn't it, across London since you know the first iterations of the London Plan and congestion charging came in and seeing more. I think driven largely by GLA and they've continued to focus on walking and cycling at healthy streets initiatives that have come forward are really, really positive, and now that's all integrated in the London Plan, and you do those assessments as you go through the planning process. But we're also seeing on some of our recent projects in Blackwall Yard in the south of Poplar, in Tower Hamlets as well. A drive to think about how we can actually allow or enable people to make different choices and move away from cars, and that's not just by providing cycle parking but different types of parking for non-standard cycles, mobility hubs. E-scooters of course are becoming more prevalent across the city as well, so thinking more dynamically about that and shared ownership and resources as well, going back to Sophia's point about the circular economy, which has certainly become the buzzword. I think it's mentioned about 40 times in the London Plan. It was mentioned twice the previous iteration. Mm-hmm. It's very much at the front and centre, isn't it, of the idea, what needs to be at the heart of sustainability these days.
And maybe this is a good time to talk about, reconciling some of those issues with tall buildings.
Yeah, and I guess there's a slightly harsh reality still that above a certain height, you're left with very few options in terms of structure and substructure for residential mm-hmm. buildings. So certainly all of the tall residential schemes that we're involved with are reinforced concrete frame buildings, sometimes with post-tensioned slabs, which does take out some of the weight in those. But increasingly within that, we're starting to see a lot more recycled aggregate and less cement content, which has a dramatic improvement on the amount of embodied carbon going into these buildings. We're starting to respond more to emerging policy in the London Plan and other documents around increasing dual aspects. So that's having a direct effect on layouts and the kind of the wall-to-floor ratios that are critical to keeping the buildings viable. So there's a balancing act to be made there, and that then feeds back into the structural arrangement. So we're working with engineers to see where we can tighten and reduce the spans of structural grids, which again takes volume and weight out of floor slabs and columns. So it's a case of doing the best within the regulatory framework that we have, and obviously there's a lot of debate and discussion around concrete versus timber, and we are seeing, fortunately, good improvement in other building typologies and other sectors and I guess fundamentally lower structures, where we're increasingly using timber and hybrid timber and steel structures. So our hope is that we can continue to realise the benefits of high-density residential building and at some point introduce those technologies to make them really function in every sense sustainably.
And when you, so to go back slightly, when you looked at your past project with your sustainability checklist, did you learn anything from that process that has informed what you're designing now?
The reality is that the bulk of the carbon footprint comes from the structure, and then some of it will come from the services. Obviously, we've been, services and, the need for reducing energy demand has been going on for one over decades, certainly in terms of regulations. But the bulk of it is first to target the structure and the efficiency of a layout, as Will just explained. And then we can look at the other. And we do have this constraint in this country, let's face it, compared to, the Scandinavia, where we can build story, like 18-story building in timber, whether it's in France also, where we have, this obligation for public building to be 50% bio-based, Canada, America, we have that regulatory constraint. We cannot get away from it now. The investors won't get, you know, won't want to put their fingers in it at this stage. I think what's happening is that we will be prepared, certainly, once we have a chance to, you know, to go and build in timber. We just don't have that opportunity at the moment, I think. That's the thing. So I would say that, and then the facade, and now, you know, what's happening nowadays is that we have more and more innovative material, also more and more traditional material, but maybe produced via renewables. So obviously, immediately that diminishes the carbon footprint, so even for, you know, brick facade. So all these elements put together, you know, help, obviously, dramatically reduce our carbon footprint. So we look at it at all angles, to be honest. I think that's the way to do it. Every little bit helps, literally.
I think another big consideration for high density and tall buildings is the quality of public realm that they're providing, and the microclimate effects that tall buildings have on public realm at ground floor, which is obviously about the public as much as it is the residents who get to live in these buildings. There have been a lot of bad examples, I suppose, in the last 20 years, which, and particularly the last 10 years, where there's been a huge increase in the amount of tall buildings. It's peaking even now, the number of planning consents coming forward for buildings over 20 stories, and indeed up to 60, 70 stories in some parts of London. So that's a really important consideration. It's one that we spend a great deal of time with our microclimate engineering teams, and certainly in the discussions in pre-application stages of our projects, it is very much close to the top of the agenda. So we're very keen that public space that's provided adjacent and around these buildings does a good service to the public who are going to be enjoying those spaces, that they get good levels of daylight and sunlight, and that they are not sort of over encumbered by strong winds. So obviously we work with a broad team of environmental engineers and wind tunnel tests and all of these things to check that those spaces can be delivered in a high quality way. And that also leads into an increasing tendency to make sure that we've got a sort of biophilic angle, to use that word, to the project. So I think everybody, the whole industry, recognises the value and the importance to well-being of having that easy access to nature, which is partly about greenery and soft landscape, but it's also about air quality and daylight and views. So it's very much part and parcel with high density that you're sort of giving back enough quality to the external spaces to compensate.
I'd love to move on a little bit. I can't believe how quickly the time has gone. But I think this summer in the UK we really felt that climate change is here, and we had the, you know, record-breaking temperatures, heat waves that were very difficult to deal with our urban form and the urban infrastructure that we have. Is this now starting to play into your design process and thinking about, you know, the new climate era that we're in?
It certainly brings it home, doesn't it? You know, I mean, just, you know, personally speaking, be able to open up both windows at the front and back of the house, you know, fairly standard Victorian terrace, but, you know, open up the windows at the back and the front at night, get that cool breeze through. And I think that's one of the things that is starting to change in, you know, in policy as well, as there's going to be a slightly reinforcement perhaps of dual aspect, and the shift towards the wording in policy is single aspect. Homes are, you know, no longer really acceptable unless, you know, very clearly justified, and that the need to really be optimizing the amount of dual aspect in it will mean that, you know, the typical plan form of buildings, both taller and medium scale, will continue to be kind of refined and need to be reconciled with their overall approach to form, and of course that's going to have, you know, impacts on efficiency and other elements of the process as well. So, you know, having that, I think the dual aspect one is clearly going to be is coming forward at the moment, and I think at the moment that's with the GLA to they're going through that process of trying to understand and provide that clarity. You know, and for us, it's critical that, you know, we start to see that soon, because as you say, you know, these schemes kind of move at pace. We're working with a number of fairly large schemes across London, and these changes will have a big impact on the way that the schemes come forward.
what's going to be interesting to see is that all of those shifts in policy, although they might appear quite subtle, they're going to have quite a dramatic impact on the typologies and, yeah, and the form and shape of buildings to come in the next 5 to 10 years. So we're, you know, we're sort of interested to be part of that journey and see how that sort of challenges us and our approach to design. But there's no doubt that the policy is heading very much in a direction that we support, and it's for the benefit of the quality of the residents' life, so we're going to occupy those buildings.
Yeah, I think overheating is obviously, I mean, as kind of mentioned by Jack, the cross ventilation is quite important. Overheating for me is going to be the biggest change that people will experience, and certainly in some of the schemes that were, you know, up to now recently built, is going to be a big issue. You know, this policy, you know, rightfully will make this, you know, harder to, even one of our projects, for instance, we had both cross ventilation and adjacent ventilation, what we call adjacent ventilation, from, you know, a facade at 90 degrees, and they wouldn't even, the climate, there was a climate officer on board, and they were not particularly keen on, you know, on recognizing that this was part of, you know, the kind of ventilation, the dual aspect, if you want, even though it's up to now has been recognized in the GLA documentation. So overheating is something we're going to have to deal with in terms also because we want to lower daylight, obviously, but we need to have to find that sweet spot balance and use more shading externally. It's not culturally something that is prevalent in the UK, but obviously if you look at Southern Europe, you know, this is
lots of colonnades.
Well, you know, colonnades, Bologna, or external shutters. You know, these are all very simple devices, in fact, but very efficient as well. So we are.
And I think it extends then again back into the sort of urban scale, where you have this heat island effect within built-up areas, which only exacerbates the problems within the homes that are within those areas. So, again, it's back to sort of how we treat landscape and how we re-green our streets to and indeed use water and the evaporative cooling benefits that plants and water can bring to that. So, you know, it's empirically proven that those sorts of benefits will sort of dramatically reduce the average temperatures, yeah, through the hotter periods, and obviously that's something that we're pleased to see coming forward in a lot of boroughs in London and a lot of our projects, and it's key to the work that we're doing at the moment in Canary Wharf, which is about sort of greening their water spaces, so they already have abundant sort of water to gain that benefit from and to offset the impact of a lot of heat generated from the hard surfaces and from the tall buildings in that estate.
It strikes me, just as you were saying, that we don't really have to reinvent the wheel with this, but maybe looking to other parts of the world that have historically been warmer. And it strikes me that probably one of the possibly an effective way of giving people a lot of relief would be giving, say, permitted development rights for people to whack shutters on the outside of their buildings. And as you said, it's not culturally something we've done. But if we're in a climate emergency, you know, we need to think of fast ways of rolling this out, and just learning from our neighbours might be a good starting point.
It happens very quickly, though, doesn't it? You know, with the year ago Insulate Britain protesters getting arrested and, you know, public nuisance, and you know, how that narrative suddenly changes so quickly with, you know, the energy price cap discussion and the environment, you know, the environment at the moment, the narrative just around things can change quite quickly and makes you think, you know.
At some point in the sort of early to mid 20th century, we discovered technologies that could cool buildings even if they did get hot inside. And I guess now we're moving from that era of high tech into one that's about low tech.
Yeah.
And it's building in passive design principles now that aren't going to rely on clever machinery and energy-consuming machinery to keep them cool. So we are very much looking back at buildings that are not all about maximising glass on the facade, but they're about very careful use and even judging how much glass to use on each orientation of the building to get the right balance of daylight and preventing overheating. And then a lot of our much bigger master planning projects that are on the books now might be over a 20 to 30 year time scale. So it would be pointless almost to hang too much on the mechanical and you know, the technological aspects of those designs. So it's very much for us about designing in sound principles that, as you say, are very time honoured, and looking back actually to the pre-modern era to gain lessons in that.
And learning from biomimicry, I suppose, is lots of astonishing example. And I mean, I think Janine Bailey, she's like an expert on it. But you know, this example of, for instance, the Namibian beetle that is able to capture through the carapace the shape of a carapace, you know, fog water, just enough, you know, to keep moisture. The, you know, all these examples that, as she says, have been in development for millions of years. Everything is there. So I think, you know, vernacular and biomimicry, so new technology based on biomimicry, I think would be fantastic, because these are, in nature, we have absolutely astonishing examples of how we can, you know, use the natural resources to our benefits without obviously undermining the environment and these natural resources in the first place. So, yeah.
Yeah, I think we're also getting into the world of natural, sort of natural materials that are able to replace, hopefully, petroleum-based products, things like insulation and that kind of thing. And they're not quite scaling up as fast as we might hope, but I hope there's some possibility for more experimentation with that in the coming years.
Yeah, no, it's definitely, I mean, Indinature, for instance, they're going to launch a new line of insulation material in October, and they say at scale, so... You know, things are happening, surely. So, yeah, natural-based material, but also using waste material at the moment. There's lots of stuff we can recuperate. So, for instance, you have insulation made of jeans, which, you know, has been used, you know, as a pilot scheme in the waste house. But, you know, now it's been also produced at scale, you know. So there's lots of examples. So, you know, using the waste, what we consider to be waste so far, but now we should value. So mining, you know, our resources from existing stuff, as well as, you know, producing stuff from hemp, for instance, that, you know, grows very quickly, or bamboo, stuff that grow really quickly. And so, you know, there's not such a threat on these resources, basically, from our demand for the building industry. So, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, the only thing I would add is maybe, you know, you are starting to see a shift in terms of where homes are being allocated around London, and a shift towards more development out of London, particularly as the political landscape shifts. Perhaps it becomes more easier to deliver homes in outer London, but we're certainly seeing that in some of our projects. This kind of, you know, challenging the suburban, the narrative of the suburbs in some way as well. We're reconciling, you know, taller buildings with sustainability. It's moving away from, you know, particularly in places that are well connected. There's many parts of out of London that have, you know, some of the highest ratings in terms of PTAL, yet remain very kind of car dependent, with, you know, low rise shopping centres and spaces that can be. Optimized and then how that interface then with density and the need to kind of optimize as London plan refers to it, density in these sort of sites. We know there's an emphasis on building taller and near in well connected sites, and, you know, next to train stations, and so, you know, I think that will be kind of, you know, over the next kind of 10 years, I think it's the first time that, you know, there's more housing allocated in outer London than in London over the time frame of that sort of London plan.
I think the other thing that we're going to see a lot more of course, is retention and adaptive reuse of existing structures. So it's now no longer the default assumption that you'll go in and demolish what's there. You'll actually give proper consideration to the potential carbon and energy savings of retaining structures. So we are starting to see that much more readily accepted by clients and developers and funders, but also challenging ourselves to find clever ways of retaining buildings on site and not having to put an extra burden on waste streams coming out of these projects. I think also because we're operating in the sort of workspace as well as the residential spheres, what's interesting is that you're starting to see the edges of those two uses starting to blur somewhat, and with the working more sort of remote working or working from home happening, and equally the other way around, workspace is increasingly needing to adapt to the demands of modern workers and people who are starting their careers in work, who have different expectations of what the workplace environment is like, which generally is seeing a much stronger trend for comfortable, more domestic type spaces and amenity spaces in the workplace. So I think that's very much a sort of work in progress, and there's a huge disparity at the moment, certainly in our industry, of whether people are sort of 5 days a week in the office or one or two. And obviously that we know there are all sorts of pros and cons to either side of that coin, but it's interesting to see how that's influencing both the residential briefs that we're working on and the workspace ones. Another way that buildings can come to terms with a shortfall in land availability in dense urban areas, such as we're working in London, is to start to adapt to water spaces. And we've just completed the water pavilions out at Wood Wharf and Canary Wharf, which are floating restaurant and retail structures on the water, so they're essentially a hollow concrete hull that was towed into place and constructed fairly locally.
Actually, the water pavilion also all you can disassemble every pieces of the structure that has gone into it, or the cladding that's gone into it. So, and the hull even itself can be then repurposed at the end of its life. If it's not for that, it can be moved away somewhere else. So that's already an example. The material I went into it. Probably a new material, but they can be completely reused. They have a life beyond the life of these two purposes at the moment.
So it's great for us to get the chance to be involved with experimental projects like that that we learn a lot from, and I guess that starts to point to potential lessons for the future in flood resilience as well, particularly in East London and on both sides of the barrier, for us to sort of learn and adapt these technologies into the future, hopefully into different uses and perhaps even for housing at some point as well, unless they do so well in the Netherlands.